This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
NBA season, the respect from those two, and that's it, it's over. This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquered the bubble, and bat number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.
All right, everybody, welcome to another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show. My name is Kyle. We are here. We are live. It is 1:02 out here on the West Coast. Thank you to everyone tuning in on Open Talk Radio 313, The Flash. And thank you to everyone tuning in on Saturday on the Take It Easy Podcast Network. If you are listening on the podcast network, please download, rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever it is that you get your podcast. I'm excited to be here. You heard the sound when we opened up the show of the Los Angeles Lakers bringing home that championship. I was surprised how much, even over the Kobe stuff, I was surprised how much they were burying the notion of Lakers winning the championship and tying the Celtics for 17th championship. And I found that to be strange because I was thinking about the Celtics not one time, because the Celtics and Lakers may have 17 championships each, but what they fail to mention is that Boston has one championship in the last 35 years, and the Lakers got a big ol' 11 championships over the last 30-plus years. I think 35 now. 40 years? 40 years-ish? Yeah. I think it's 9 if you go from 1985. But I digress anyway. It's been 4 days since their championship, and already Rajon Rondo has opted out. Dwight Howard is hitting free agency. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope opted out, to the grand delight of Laker fans everywhere. It was a celebratory moment for the Lakers when Kentavious Caldwell-Pope opted out. And he's never gotten his money. He was a draft pick by the Pistons, and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope went straight from there to the Lakers. Now he's made $30 million in his time with the Lakers. And he made, I believe it was about $13 million from his time with the Pistons. So Kentavious has never really gotten that big contract. And he's going to take the big money to go play for the terrible team like the Knicks or the Hornets, or I guess the Grizzlies maybe, or the Pistons, but he's already played with the Pistons, but the Pistons have the most cap space, which they're probably going to burn on Fred VanVleet while also trying to trade Blake Griffin. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope talk. I am very happy to go there. 105, no games live today. With baseball coming to an end, there aren't going to be a lot of live games to focus in on. But at the end of the show, we will get first pitch. Right after we go off the air, we will get first pitch of Game 5 between the Astros and the Tampa Bay Rays. That's going to be fun. That Game 4 is going to be really fun between the Braves and the Dodgers. But if you're listening tonight, or if you're listening on Saturday over on the podcast network, Game 6 is going to be even more fun on Saturday night. If you're listening and it's already Game 6, that's going to be really fun in that Braves and Dodgers series to watch that Game 6. Where I want to begin the show today, and you know that when we come on here, I guess for the first part of the show, I go deep into a big topic that I'm interested in. And I am interested this week with what is going on in college football. As I've said before, I talked about it before, everything is just too hot with college football right now. I'm not paying close attention to the games. I'm not trying to follow everything going on. I'm not into the gambling apart from just doing it for entertainment purposes for the podcast, which, by the way, we are 13-9 on the season this year. So we are, 13-7. We are crushing it this year. We are 15-7. Apologies. We are crushing it on the picks this year. But apart from that, I have not had much interest in college football. I watched 15 minutes of TCU in Texas. I watched the end of Clemson in Miami. I skipped the greatest Red River rivalry in a while because it's all too hot right now, both with now the politicization of college football, which we've alluded to a number of times about how college football has become a political issue. Back in September, when the Big 12 announced its cancellation and everything else was getting underway, politics invaded the scene because it was a rallying point. It was an election point. And when that swarms in on everything, it just, the narrative gets totally hijacked. When you have the mass media and specifically the political media, not media with political bias, just media that covers politics. When political media invades something, just gets blown out of proportion, whether it be something crazy like people standing outside a courthouse wearing Kobe Bryant jerseys back in 2003, all the way to unmarked vehicles taking people away in Portland, Oregon. Like, it can get totally out of hand when media descends upon something. And that's what happened in college football. It was all too hot, and I wanted to stay away. And this doesn't even ignore the biggest plague in college football, which is COVID outbreaks left and right across college football. And if you're looking for a sign that says COVID is, like, college football during COVID is a bad idea because the administration cannot protect these players. They won't protect those players, not because they're malevolent and not because they hate kids and want to see kids get sick. They can't protect these kids, and they won't protect these kids because there's no incentive for them to protect these kids. And if you don't create an incentive, you're counting on a moral obligation to do the right thing. And I don't even like critique people for saying a moral obligation means giving up potentially hundreds of millions of dollars and the future of the industry by not playing. I don't even blame them for that one. It's just the fact that they don't have an incentive to protect the kids. And as we've seen over the last 50 years, if you don't have an incentive for something, it will just never change. Natural change does not occur for the majority and the late majority. It's kind of in the phrase itself. The majority is the people who follow after people who are innovative make innovation, and the people, early adopters, adopt them. It's why we all have cell phones in our pocket now. It began with some people who had cell phones. The early majority got on the cell phone craze, and then it disseminated to the masses. We ended last week's radio show talking about the law of diffusion of innovation, and it works the same way. 2.5% of your population is your innovators. 12.5% is your early majority. The next 67.5% is your early majority and your late majority, and then your last 12.5%, your last 15-ish percent is your everyone else. Everyone else is late majority. These are the people who still carry around flip phones, and were pro-segregationists in the 1950s and are still hanging on to that claim today. That's your late majority. And so as information disseminates to the masses, the majority follows the leaders, or at least in this case, the innovators, which is a separate name, and of course the early majority, which is just trusted people who are willing to make leaps and bounds. All of this ties back into college football, which is probably important to get back to, because if you don't have incentive for something, the majority will just get away with it. They will not hold a moral obligation. They will get away with it, and they will get the money, potentially at the risk of thousands of COVID diagnoses like we've already seen to start this college football season. And if you're looking for a sign that this might be a bad idea, I'd point you to the University of Florida. Because the University of Florida, which for the longest time was a school with two national championships. They were teetering on that dynastic level. Miami in the late 80s was a dynasty. Alabama and Clemson are dynasties. LSU is a dynasty, but first with Les Miles and now with Ed Orgeron, the swamp monster Ed Orgeron. They were teetering along that line. And what we saw was a football team for Florida, coached by a guy named Dan Mullen. Dan Mullen used to coach at Mississippi State. He was the head coach for Dak Prescott. They made it to the number one in the first college football playoff ranking. That's a fun Aflac trivia question if you're ever watching college football. Who was the first ever number one ranked team in the college football playoff? Answer, Mississippi State with Dak Prescott. And that's how Dan Mullen took that job and went from Mississippi State to Florida, where he was an offensive coordinator with Urban Meyer, who won the championships with Tim Tebow, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, so what happens is Dan Mullen this weekend is ranked number four in the country, and they took an L versus Texas A&M. Because, of course, they did. They're Florida. They're going to take an L against Texas A&M and play in the Orange Bowl and play in the Cotton Bowl because that's Florida. They're going to be good, not great, kind of just teetering around that number 10 spot. And Florida took that L to Texas A&M, and Dan Mullen said, you know what, we need to put 90,000 people in the swamp in Gainesville. It is legal now, according to the state governor. You can put as many people as you'd like in these stadiums. Everyone is deciding that's insane, and they're following CDC guidelines. And you can put as many as you want in the stadium, and Mullen was advocating for that over the weekend. You hear it on a conventional talk radio, whatever you want to call it. And then just 2 days later, he has an outbreak of COVID on his team. If that's not like a message from the gods or whatever it is, from the COVID gods or whatever deity you worship, if that ain't a message from the gods, I don't know what is. When he's calling for 90,000 people to show up at their stadium and just immediately having a COVID outbreak, like that is impeccable timing by whatever God is out there, whatever deity you worship. That is just unbelievable timing. And so the Gators are in this position where they're going to have a COVID outbreak. They're going to play with less people. They may have infected the other team, but at this point, I feel like everyone is infected across college football. There have already been cases at small schools about faking with testing and manipulating testing results. We've already seen outbreaks where Vanderbilt couldn't play this last weekend. Houston has had three games suspended by three different teams that have had COVID outbreaks. Virginia Tech has had a COVID outbreak. Now Florida has a COVID outbreak. Oklahoma State has had a COVID outbreak. Baylor has a COVID outbreak. There's been dozens of these already. Thousands of college football players have gotten it. Clemson and Texas, on the other hand, they just got their COVID outbreaks out of the way in June. That way everyone could come back and have herd immunity and they'd be good to go for the season. Just generally an awful idea, but worked out in their favor. It's the same weird, like, incentive world. We were talking about incentives about 5 minutes ago. It's the weird incentive world where it would be better for an NFL team like the Broncos to get an outbreak instead of lose your bye week because you had to play New England and they had a COVID outbreak and you lost your bye week as a result of that. So it's a weird world where you're incentivized to get an outbreak if you're going to lose games like the Titans did, and they looked well rested and they beat the crap out of the Bills, even though they didn't have Corey Davis or Adam Humphries or Jeffrey Simons, but they still had Derrick Henry and Ryan Tannehill and Josh Allen on the other side of the ball. Not that I'm hating on Josh Allen, but he did have two interceptions that cost them the game. So with that being said, in this weird world of incentives, you're going to have to incentivize schools to look after their players in order to get players to be safe. Is that going to happen? No. They're going to do the thing that people in power always do, which they've already done, which is basically break the unions. They broke the unions, and everyone is going to go back to work, even though, oh, yeah, they're making 16 cents on the dollar, according to a Drexel University study. College football players make 16 cents on the dollar with their scholarship and their MacBook and their free gear and free food. They get 16 cents on the dollar for what they are worth to that university, which is why the system of college football still exists, is because they can get cheap labor and make a bleep ton of money. So we've talked about college football a couple times here, and we've talked about how college football has been in this position where you have to create an incentive. I think this was our second episode. Like, Martez, we've been together for 2 months now. Isn't that something? But we've been watching this go on from the beginning when we had the Pac-12 We Are United movement. And then you had the Big Ten's We Are United movement, that they were united in, we just want these things, but we're not going to withhold our labor. Again, the schools have no incentive to give those things to you. Otherwise, they would have given those things to you. And so we talked about Florida has the legislation that is going to allow people to recruit in football. You can name image likeness laws are passed in Florida, in California, I think in Ohio. So it's like red and blue states alike are passing name image and likeness laws. This is a universally agreed upon thing. Cory Booker is a U.S. senator who is working on name, image, likeness laws. He used to play as an offensive lineman at Stanford back in the 1990s. But anyways, he's focusing on name, image, and likeness laws to pursue college athletes being able to profit off of themselves, which is just a way to circumvent the schools not paying their athletes, is name, image, and likeness laws. And as those come into effect, we have to create incentives, and by we, I mean like policymakers need to create incentives for college teams to implement their own name, image, likeness laws, get payrolls for their players, as far as you personally would like to have the extent. I personally would like to go to the extent of having collegiate athletes be on a payroll making $250,000 a year, depending on which guy you are, instead of the under the table method now that only gets filtered to future NFL stars. I would like that idea to be in effect in an idealized world that I know is a far ways away. Is there a path to achieve that? Yes. There are infinite resources. The only thing you need to achieve something or advance a cause, the only thing you need to advance a cause and advance a pursuit is will and resources. This is the basic definition of the infinite game. And there are infinite resources to work with, whether it be from universities, whether it be from apparel companies, whether it be from agents looking to represent players. There are infinite methods to achieve resources. Infinite resources, no will. And the way you're going to change the will is by changing the incentives. And so what we're seeing right now when it comes to the University of Florida, when it comes to the University of Alabama and how that relates to COVID, and how I talked about Virginia Tech and Baylor and Texas and Houston, even though Houston doesn't have an outbreak, they've just been with other places that have outbreaks, and Vanderbilt and BYU, all the way on down. Like, there's been dozens of COVID outbreaks all the way to Clemson and now Bama with Nick Saban testing positive. If you keep going all the way down the list, you're going to see COVID outbreaks and just move along with your day. You get COVID, you recover from it, you move on. We don't know the science, but it seems to be not as bad as it seems. You're going to have all those cases underlined with the fact that the Big Ten starts football this weekend. The Big Ten starts football this weekend with everything going on. We're adding more college football in there. The Mountain West starts next weekend. The Pac-12 starts the weekend after that. And it's just all coming down. The reason the Pac-12 is playing is because they broke the union. The We Are United movement said that they would withhold labor to achieve X things and work with the universities. They broke their union. They basically said, look, we are more than happy to just pack it up and go home. We already did it once. We can do it again. So they broke that union. If you want to play football, you're going to play by our rules because they don't got the power. And why would universities break that if they knew that they couldn't? And why would the NCAA break it on a universal level? Because it's the moral right thing to do? Well, they would just shut down operation because it's a corporation. All these universities are corporations, and the NCAA is the head corporation that I guess just takes a profit for organizing stuff. I guess that's the NCAA's main function, but basically what you have to do here is create those incentives, and the unions have been broken, more COVID outbreaks are going on, and you just keep it moving along. And obviously it's very hot on the politicization. And now there's going to be a perfect representation of that this weekend, where LSU in Florida was supposed to be the second biggest game of the weekend. The biggest game of the weekend was Alabama versus Georgia. And this is perfect representation right here on the University of Florida against LSU, game canceled. Second best game of the weekend, canceled. Georgia versus Alabama, still on right now, but you're not going to see the face of the sport on that sidelines. And who I'm referring to is, of course, Nick Saban, because Nick Saban has tested positive for COVID. And I made the joke over on the Instagram that if Nick Saban is on the sidelines on Saturday, don't be surprised that doctors in Tuscaloosa just gave him a 3-day quarantine diagnosis so he could get out and coach the Georgia game. Like, that's where we're at this point. And it's coronavirus has become the most politicized issue in America, I want to say, since race. But again, race is still an ongoing thing, so race maybe has them there. If we had to do the stupid ranking system, I think race would probably come in just ahead of coronavirus. But coronavirus is right up there, especially on October 15th of 2020. And coronavirus is in this position of – I'd like describing coronavirus like that before I get to that point. But coronavirus, by that I mean the pandemic. The pandemic is in this position where it's going to keep going on. It's been 7 months now, and a lot of people are starting to break. And everyone's got to get this money. Like, it's not an easy world, but – the politicization of it is not because coronavirus would have been political under normal circumstances. It's because coronavirus happened in an election year. One could argue it's this election year. Like, if this had happened back in 2012, I don't necessarily think we're talking about the same issues at hand. But when we are talking about coronavirus, when it comes to swaying an election, elections are going to be swayed by a bunch of white suburban people in Ohio and a bunch of white suburban people in Florida and a bunch of white suburban people in Wisconsin. That's who decides your elections, because the lines are pretty much drawn well across the rest of the way. Unless Texas goes blue, which would be really surprising, not for just the fact that Texas is going blue, period, but just it happening in 2020. Like, Texas is going to be blue sooner rather than later. But the fact that it would happen in 2020 is understandably rather remarkable. But it's white people in Ohio, it's white people in Florida, and white people in Wisconsin that are determining the elections. And what are those people pro? Generally pro college football. And that's where the politicization comes in. It's just one of the many things that will help sway an election. Like I said, it's all very hot right now. And ideals about coronavirus are tied to whatever their party is. I assume if you're a moderate, you're probably pro wearing a mask. If you're moderate, you're probably pro let's try and limit the spread of coronavirus. And you're probably pro science, but you're probably economically pro conservative and pro-left taxes, and a lot of people can be one-issue voters on this stuff. It's a very difficult line to draw. And so as we keep progressing, it's going to be interesting to watch that play out, but also watch what happens with college football, because with college football and COVID, it reflects society. And college football, being a traditional sport that it is and being a conservative sport that it is, at least it appeals predominantly to conservative fan bases, predominantly is being the key word, not entirely, but predominantly, and I don't think that's a controversial statement of any kind, but with that being said, follow where the COVID situation goes and follow where the politics goes, especially when it comes to what Florida and Alabama have breaking out at their schools and universities. So we talked a little basketball earlier, and we gave some KCP thoughts. If you want some baseball breakdown, I would check out the Take It Easy podcast. With baseball, it's kind of difficult because with this radio platform, I like to do broad topics. But when it comes to baseball, especially in the playoffs, it's difficult because everything is like bang, 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 over and over and over again in this position where baseball baseball is day to day. You've got to watch it every single night because everything is changing. And we've gotten to game four of a series, which is basically 4 days in October time. Once you get to game four of the series is when everything starts feeling more intense. So let's go back to basketball. And a headline that came in after we recorded the podcast today, that Daryl Morey was quote-unquote, stepping down as the general manager of the Houston Rockets. And stepping down is the same thing as someone taking a break when you break up in a relationship. It is, I wish they had gone with mutually agreed to part ways instead of stepping down, because mutually agreed to part ways means mutually agreeing that he was fired. And the Rockets want someone else to run this tear down. They're going to stick with the analytics model. I think Tilden Fertitta is a smart enough guy to recognize that this worked, that analytics ball is a really, really smart idea, and it's a really, really good way to be innovative. More innovation will come, maybe out of the Rockets, maybe out of someone else. The Rockets did innovate the three-point strategy, but they also followed the innovation the Denver Nuggets had when they put Nikola Jokic as the point center, and the Rockets did the same thing with Russell Westbrook. So it'll be someone else that gets to decide the teardown for the Rockets. And firing is really a unique case, but it's also a textbook case in teaching people about legacy. And legacy, when it comes to Daryl Morey and the Houston Rockets, is certainly a very, very complex and fascinating legacy. So let's talk about legacy here for a bit, because I am very interested in how the legacy thing plays out. Because, putting it quite frankly, nobody, and I mean nobody, gets to decide their legacy. There are people who are obsessed with manipulating the narrative and trying to control their own legacy. It doesn't work, but they're going to try anyways. People in power desire to dictate their importance, from Kevin Durant to Donald Trump to everywhere in between, you're going to get people in power trying to control their own legacies. And so with Maury, he will be remembered by three groups of people in three very, very different ways. Daryl Morey is going to be remembered in distinct ways based on where you fall along an ideology line, where you fall along a political spectrum, and where you fall along the law of diffusion of innovation, specifically as a sports fan. And which type, where you fall on that spectrum, will determine what type of opinion you probably have about Daryl Morey, which is a perfect example of how sports reflect our society, especially when it comes to this idea of legacy, because I think everyone thinks about their legacy in some way, shape, or form, whether it is as a parent and shaping your child to be an image as your legacy and being a bad parent and doing that, or whether it is being a person in power and a person of influence who is controlling their own legacy, like Kevin Durant, who is obsessed with how people think about him. So the first one, and I want to address all three here, because questions about the Rockets as a team will be answered with time, et cetera, et cetera. They have four draft picks that they've lost now because of trades. Harden is exiting his prime. Westbrook may have already exited his prime, but they found a nice niche way to make Westbrook a point center because he gets a lot of rebounds and he scores a lot at the rim, so they make Westbrook a point center. But D'Antoni is gone. Morey is gone. Harden is exiting his prime. That time is over in Houston. This is a time of transition for the Houston Rockets. And if the Rockets were smart, they would tear it all down this year to finish a year early instead of a year late, like Oklahoma City did last year to get 11 first-round picks in 6 years. That would be the smart move by the Rockets, whether they do it or not. They probably won't do it. It's just the timing of all this is fascinating. And, you know, bringing in a new GM, a new coach usually means new regime. Starting off in Houston, I would expect them to go into the rebuilding phase sooner rather than later. So let's get back to Daryl Morey and those legacies. The first legacy, and this is the one that I fall under. This is how I view Daryl Morey's legacy. Number one is Daryl Morey. His legacy is the NBA's Billy Beane. And for those who don't know who Billy Beane is, Billy Beane is the guy from the Oakland Athletics who, with Michael Lewis, a great writer, authored the book Moneyball. Moneyball was basically the ideology of using analytics in order to improve a roster and compete at a higher level, find value where others do not find value. And that will ultimately help you win games. You can buy wins, but you can also secure value. And the securing value is a better option than buying wins, which buying wins was the model of, I guess, 50 to 100 years of sports before Moneyball. That was the predominant ideology of success, was how do we buy more wins? How do we buy victories? And so Daryl Morey was the first great pioneer of an analytics-driven NBA front office. While the Warriors were the most successful analytics model, Morey was the pioneer before everyone else got there. Morey was the guy when he was named Houston's GM in 2008. He inherited an aging team of Yao Ming, Ron Artest, and Tracy McGrady. And it wasn't so much the results that were a product of that turnaround, because it took a long time for them to right that ship after Yao Ming, Artest, and McGrady got knocked out in the first round 2 years in a row. It wasn't just that. It was the style of play and the process by which the Rockets were assembled. And process is obviously connotative with Sam Hinkie, but Sam Hinkie did not get to start the process without Daryl Morey's hiring. Morey wanted to build a three-point juggernaut. The numbers say, and the data says, that a three-point juggernaut is important, and it is something that everyone is not taking advantage of enough. He couldn't take advantage of that until he acquired James Harden from the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Rockets have broken every conceivable three-point record in NBA history. As a team, they have broken every single three-point record in NBA history. In the 8 years since they acquired Harden, the Rockets took more threes than any other franchise, and the gap between them and the Golden State Warriors, who were second place, them and the Warriors was the same gap as the Warriors and 24th place in that time. They shot an astronomical number of threes, more than the Golden State Warriors, which versus everyone else was just absolute calamities and craziness. So that was Maury's great idea, and D'Antoni was the right coach for that because of his 7 seconds or less, which eventually fell apart, and the Rockets fell apart, and D'Antoni left basically feeling like, I've done all I can with this team. It's time to move on to something else. And while Maury rebuilt the Rockets at the beginning, this was the pre-Harden stuff, this was back when he was trading Kyle Lowry to the Rockets for a first-round pick, or trading him to the Raptors for a first-round pick. When Maury was making those decisions, he co-founded the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. And the yearly congregation was used as propaganda to show franchises the importance of analytics at a time where franchises did not have analytics departments. And it was a breeding ground for new ideas to be shared among large groups of people. In 2017, something that we had was Barack Obama getting to be the host of that week and give the introductory speech for the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. And so I followed this path for one, Daryl Morey. I think that, or I love sports, obviously I love sports, and I also love analytics, and I love, I'm not obviously as well versed as a lot of people with analytics, but I love sports, I love analytics, and I love, love, love innovation. I love new ideas. I like new ways of thinking about different things that seem so obvious, but there's a deeper level than what we're seeing on the screen. And this guy, Daryl Morey, was a pioneer of the greatest sports innovation of my lifetime, and probably of Martez's lifetime, and probably of most people who are born 1980 and after's lifetime. And it allowed him, along with Sam Hinkie and Bob Myers and Andy Ellisberg and Sashi Brown, who ended up being with the Wizards and then going on to the Cleveland Browns, it allowed those guys to get jobs and change the game themselves in their own ways. You see what the Browns are becoming now. That's Sashi Brown's doing. Sashi Brown did that. John Dorsey was in there too, and they've got another guy in there now after John Dorsey was fired. But the same idea reigns true, is that Cleveland has that to their credit, was what Sashi Brown built for the Browns. And so Maury never got that big trophy, and neither has Billy Beane. And so his legacy in that case will be knocking down the brick wall, because this is the thing that happened with everyone who is a great innovator, is that the first person through the door and through the brick wall has to knock down the wall for everyone else. They're going to get battered and beaten, and after they knock down the wall, they're going to be exhausted, and everyone behind them is going to trample right over them on their way to advance to whatever it's going to be. It's a cutthroat business. You break down the wall, everyone else is going to stomp over you to get to whatever is desired beyond that wall. And so when it came to Colin Kaepernick, the same thing happened. Colin Kaepernick sacrificed in order for everyone else that came after him to have an easier opportunity to voice their thoughts on Black Lives Matter, on police brutality, and making a statement while being an athlete and pissing off a lot of white people. And for Daryl Morey, the same thing happened. He had to break down the brick wall so that other people could enter the industry, and that his analytics-driven mindset could last long beyond after Daryl Morey moved out of the game. And that's ultimately how you change the game, is with innovation. Number two, the second group of people that we are talking about here, these are the 0-27 guys who are trying to make sports boring, as I like to call it. They're trying to make sports boring again and make sports traditional. When someone holds sports as a sacred cathedral, and it is sacred and nobody can impinge on it because it is beautiful as it is, and sports are sacred in that way. You've probably heard that a lot over the last 8 months, but when someone holds sports as a sacred cathedral, the thing they hate more than anything is a guy who disparages and threatens that cathedral. When Daryl Morey talks about passing up layups for three-point jumpers, it goes against everything we are trained to believe from the earliest ages to think about basketball. Morey had ideas that no one else was focused on and said things no one else was saying, like we encourage guys to pass up layups for three-pointers. The numbers say over the long run we will be better because of that. Because we have talented players and because we can shoot threes, the numbers support the idea that a corner three is a better shot than a layup because it's worth 3 points and every other shot is worth 2 points. And you're going to make more open threes than you're going to make layups, even if they're contested. And so Morey came after the cathedral with numbers and data. And the guardians of that cathedral met him with hostility. And those weapons that he was using, numbers and data, discredit the numbers and data. Since you can't take the weapons away from him, the only thing you can do is say that they aren't weapons and degrade them as weapons themselves. And so it's in their best tactic, and by them I mean the guardians of the cathedral of sports, it is in their best tactic to attack ideas they don't agree with, and they don't agree with what they've been taught from the youngest ages of childhood about how sports are meant to be through tribalism. Call it emotion, call it ignorance, call it whatever you feel it is. The bottom line is that people will protect that cathedral with ugly, disparaging tactics because it's everything that they have. It is every best option that they have available in such a case. The side effects of this hostility include disparaging, discrediting, and finding any excuse to say, why should I not care about what is happening? This is at the heart of all forms of discrimination, especially when it comes to the subjugation of minority groups by non-white people, disparaging of minority groups by white people, or the subjugation of gay and trans people by straight cisgender people. These are the real societal conflicts that have been fought for dozens of generations now. And like I mentioned a second ago, tribalism passes these ideologies down to the majority, at least the majority on the law of diffusion of the innovation spectrum. It passes those ideas down to the majority. And so we don't even force the majority to change. That's the other problem that we have with society right now. We don't force the majority to change. We let the majority stay the same. Often we promote them into positions of power to influence what the majority is, and that's not a good leader. A leader is not the majority. The majority is meant to follow the leaders. The leaders are supposed to help them improve whatever it is they're going to be. Now, when the leaders don't do a good job, it may be rejected and they'll just promote other people, but those other people are not good leaders, and at some point they're not looking for good leadership, and it turns down the whole path that we're talking about where we have protests in the streets and people burning, and despite the fact that, I'm sorry, buildings burning, people in the streets, and despite the fact that 7% of protests in America are violent, 42% of people associate all of protests with violence. when it comes to Black Lives Matter in the streets. So what does this have to do with Daryl Morey? Well, it has everything to do with Daryl Morey, and quite frankly, in a sense, the only way it doesn't is if I am not doing a good job of communicating that, which is probably very likely. That's very likely that I am not the best communicator in the world. But sports, I talk about all this societal stuff because sports reflect our society. It is the number one reason why I love sports. Sports reflect society. And the Houston Rockets were this different group, discredited by people who don't like things that are different. And it really, I could have just said that at the beginning and it makes a whole lot of sense instead of the cathedral thing. The Rockets were different and they were discredited by people who don't like things that are different. And the tactics they used include calling the Rockets boring, despite the fact James Harden is the greatest offensive weapon of my lifetime, discrediting the Rockets' successes and discrediting the Rockets' successes, but also discrediting or enhancing their failures, like the fact that James Harden is a four-time top two player in the NBA. Four times he finished top two in the conference finals voting. And what ended up happening to James Harden was a discrediting, despite the fact he is the greatest offensive weapon in the world. So simply put, like I said before, the Rockets were different and people don't like things that are different. And this was, like I mentioned before, the 0-27 game really put that into perspective for all of us. It really put things into perspective when it came to the Houston Rockets and when it came to disparaging what it is that they did because they infringed upon that sacred cathedral. Number three, the third group on here, we talked about those who view him in a positive light as this generation's Billy Beane. We talked about the people who discredited the Rockets for infringing upon their sacred sports cathedral. So let's talk about this third group, which is the non-sports fans who use Daryl Morey's Hong Kong controversy to further their own agenda. And this third part has less to do about Morey and more to do about America's political climate and the globalized political climate. And this goes back to communism and pro-democracy in the 1940s and the 1950s. All of this is ingrained in really a century. If you go back really to World War II, almost a century of communist vendetta versus democracy and globalization, et cetera, et cetera. So the NBA is a political organization. This is a good thing. The NBA is a predominantly black league with a lot of influence in popular culture. They should be using this platform to push pro-Black Lives Matter messages and pro-Black Lives Matter, quote-unquote, policies. Only one of the two major political parties in this idea only one of two major political parties is supportive of such ideas, and that is the Democratic Party. The key word there being supporting, not advancing. They are throwing their support and saying they are supporting, but they don't have a pro, like, forward-thinking ideology. They just want things to stay the same and get the votes from people who are pro-Black Lives Matter groups. And so what you're looking at here is a group of people who are not exactly happy with this, and that is the Republican Party. The Republican Party has their own agenda to appease groups who will give them a vote every two Novembers, and specifically this year when it comes to a presidential campaign. And so they're going to use tactics to disparage the competition, the same way both political organizations and political parties do. They're going to disparage the groups in an effort to promote whatever it is they are and hopefully get votes. This is a result of 1990s and 2000s changes along political ideologies where it's about winning or being right instead of about, you know, policy and working together and all of that good stuff. And so here we are, and there is no real sense that Daryl Morey did anything wrong. No one's saying that. And Daryl Morey got kind of caught in the crossfire and handed the Republican Party a disparaging tactic in a breadbasket last year. Morey's tweet is going to cost the NBA more in lost revenue than coronavirus. China is a major global superpower with a lot of money. They wanted the NBA there. If China wanted the NFL there, we'd be talking about the NFL in the same way. If they wanted MLB there, we'd be talking about MLB the same way we talk about the NBA. And the NBA got caught in the crossfire between China and pro-capitalism Americans, the same group who elected President Trump in 2016, which I think at that time might have included myself, but I was 15 years old, so I didn't really understand how all that worked. I just viewed it as a game back then. Now I guess I'm older. I have certainly more experience than I was now and understand it a little bit more. So I guess I was in that group, but I also didn't view it as a teenager would. So, yeah. And now even a year later, the whataboutism tactic is being used to discredit the NBA's efforts to affect domestic policy and domestic race relations. And so here we are now where their argument, and by them I mean the Republican Party, says that if the NBA doesn't care about broad human rights violations in China, they should be discredited from commenting on the broad human rights violations in America. Does that make sense? No. Does it serve their agenda? Yes. Do they follow basketball? Probably not. Are people boycotting basketball? That's the narrative that's being pushed. I don't think it is, but I also have no data to confirm it. It seems insane to think about, but I also don't have data to confirm it. And I was talking all about pro data earlier. So Morey and the NBA get caught up in this mess less than a year in advance of the NBA taking the largest stand on racial injustice by a sports corporation of the last 50 to 60 years, going back to Bill Russell and company and that famous photo during the civil rights movement. The groups pushing back on this will discredit the NBA because it's a winning tactic for election campaigns. And the truth is, there's a certain group that they are appealing to. And that group happens to be the one to vote, to cast votes for them. And 90 to 99% of the time, it's pandering to the same people who fall under group number two that we discussed earlier, the group who discredits the Rockets for infringing upon the sacred sports cathedral because tribalism has taught them that that is the tactic to achieve what, or that is the tactic to get through in life, but also the tactic to, this is how the world is supposed to be, and this is how they were taught the world operates. So that is the way in which we find ourselves in such a position. We are just 10 minutes away from the beginning of the baseball Game 5 saga between the Rays and the Astros. The Rays can clinch that playoff spot tonight. Don't let the Astros back in it, baby. I'm hoping good things for Manuel Margot. I'm hoping good things for Randy Arozarena. But the fanarchist in me wants to see the Rays do well. I was talking to Bill Thompson about this on Sunday, about how when we follow this storyline of Rays versus Astros, is that the Rays are very much anti-labor. I think that they bodies are disposable. They aren't viewed in such a way, and Tampa Bay is this unique case. And if they advance the World Series, I'm for it, because as I just talked about in the Daryl Morey story, there is a fascination I have with the Tampa Bay Rays because of the innovation. They are smarter than everybody else. Tampa Bay is doing things better than everybody else. And so what we find is that the Tampa Bay Rays, who are, again, one game from the World Series, by the time we're talking next week, it'll be game three of the World Series, or if you're listening next Saturday, game five of the World Series. Tampa Bay is in a position where they can win the whole thing. They look to be superior to the Braves. I don't know about the Dodgers, but again, it's a 50-50 shot at who wins that Braves-Dodgers series. Tonight is going to be a captivating, captivating game four that I will be glued to the television for, with singular focus, because there is no football tonight. Chiefs and Bills have been moved over to Monday. I was going to talk about the Rams, but maybe that'll come up with our buddy Strike Hype Bengals on the podcast tomorrow, which you can all check out over on the Take It Easy Podcast Network. If you're listening to this podcast on the Take It Easy Podcast Network, just wait until this episode ends in 3 minutes and just play right into the next episode. Download it regardless. Quick plug. So the Tampa Bay Rays, we talked about them last week in the Law of Diffusion of Innovation, and here they are again, ready to advance. And they are in a position where I'm rooting for them, but I'm not sure most people are rooting for them. The fan artist in me does want to see the Astros win, just to kind of put it in everyone's face, because I don't have any problem with what the Astros did. Was it cheating? By definition of the law, yes. How do you enforce it in baseball? Give me a good answer for how you enforce it. And not just an answer. Give me a good answer for how you can enforce sign stealing policy in baseball. It is nearly impossible at this stage of the game. And so this is where we find ourselves headed into this game five, is Tampa Bay, not many people rooting for them. The Dodgers and the Braves, certainly in positions of power, but there is still a lot of question marks, and it's baseball, so everything's random in the first place anyways. For those who may not be big time baseball fans, like, baseball is random for that reason, that we have players and we have games where the sample sizes are too small to be able to get answers. And the players can go hot or cold at any time. But the Chicago Cubs won the World Series in 2016, and since then their four best players are hitting like 130 in the postseason. Like, it's random. Altuve has made three unheard errors in this series to help them lose to the Rays. The Astros might be a great team. They might be better than the Rays. They were favored at the beginning of the series ever so slightly. It's why I think that the Rays need to put them away sooner rather than later to avoid letting this go to six or seven games. I think the Rays will be fine. I don't think they'll lose four straight to the Astros, but doesn't mean it's not impossible. Especially not with this team that is actually really, really good in Tampa Bay or Houston. So that's going to be an interesting storyline to watch. Another interesting storyline to watch, and I know they may be listening on Saturday, and we don't have time to get into this. This is the fourth thing I was interested in today. This is Sean McVay's best coaching job. He is using – when he won in 2018, Sean McVay was using the players that he had before, and now he is using the players that he wants to have. He has a roster tailored to what he wants to do, specifically on the offensive side of the ball. When it comes to having Cooper Kupp and having Brandon Cooks and having this running back committee and having Jared Goff run the different plays, and now he's a little more developed, et cetera, et cetera. This is Sean McVay's finest coaching job. I could have done 10 minutes on that. I gave you 30 seconds. Maybe you understood that better than all the fluff that I gave you over the last hour on college football and Daryl Morey. But regardless, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping in to the Take It Easy radio show. Check us out on the podcast feed, Take It Easy Podcast. If you're listening on said podcast feed, there is a link in the description to this episode. Subscribe to Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash, available on Blog Talk Radio. You don't have to sign up, just subscribe. Maybe you can put in an email and you'll get episodes about with the other great stuff here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. We got Rated R Wrestling coming up next, I do believe. Thank you, everybody, for stopping into the show today. My name is Kyle. We're going to go watch some baseball. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.